warnings came as Israeli forces continued to breach the Gaza ceasefire, killing four civilians, including a woman. The death toll from the regime's genocide now exceeds 70,300, with more than 171,000 others injured. Rights groups have slammed Israel over the situation in the regime's prison, saying that deteriorating conditions and systematic neglect are causing death of Palestinian abductees. This came after a new report revealed that 110 Palestinians have been killed in Israeli jail since far-right minister Itamar Ben-Gvir took office in December 2022. Gad Ibrahim reports.
At least 110 Palestinian abductees have been killed while in Israeli detention. That's according to a new report. It said many of the detainees are regularly subjected to torture, assault, medical neglect, and malnutrition.
After October 7th, Israel's systematic violence and torture against Palestinian prisoners increased rapidly, and this is not only reflected by the increase of fatalities, but also in the witnesses we hear from and the ex-prisoners. Gaza's prisoners are still subjected to more brutal and inhumane treatment, which was noticed more clearly since Ben-Gvir came into office. His policies are reflecting his own extremism.
Ben-Gvir, who oversees Israel's prison system, openly boasts about rising fatalities in Israeli jails. Those close to Ben-Gvir maintain that the hawkish Israeli minister is proud to have aggravated conditions for Palestinian abductees.
I was in prison for nearly 2 years, during which I was subjected to extreme torture and medical neglect. For 4 months, I had scabies, and they refused to give any medicine. Starvation was another method of torture. We would go for days without food, or with the minimum that kept us alive. We witnessed the death of many people inside the prison. One prisoner was Dr. Mossab Hania, who was tortured to death for his last name only.
In addition to the 18,500 documented arrests since October 2023, there are an unknown number taken as part of an Israeli policy of enforced disappearances. 2 years on, thousands of those disappeared from Gaza may no longer be alive. For the 110 Palestinian prisoners who never made it home, the suffering may have ended. However, for the thousands who are still behind the Israeli bars, the agony persists. Gad Ibrahim, Deir el-Balah City, Palestine.
Hamas has strongly condemned a report by Amnesty International which alleges that the Palestinian resistance has committed crimes during Operation Al-Aqsa Flood against Israel. It called the report biased and suspicious as it contains fallacies and contradictions with facts documented by rights groups. Hamas said Amnesty International's report is just repetition of Israel's lies and allegations. The movement stressed that the main goal of the report is incitement and defaming the resistance by adopting the fascist Israeli regime's narrative. It added that all the report's allegations have been already denied and refuted by numerous related international investigations and reports. Hamas said it has been proven that Israeli forces destroyed settlers' homes and buildings using tanks and aircraft and killed civilians under the so-called Hannibal Protocol. Hamas urged Amnesty International to retract its false and unprofessional report and avoid distorting facts to demonize the Palestinian people and their legitimate resistance. It stressed that the report is trying to cover up Israel's crimes, which are under review by the International Court of Justice and the International Criminal Court under the titles of genocide. Investigative journalist Tony Gosling says there is evidence that the Israeli forces have killed settlers under the so-called Hannibal Protocol. Let us hear more.
It's an investigation, but the question is it impartial? And most importantly, is it fearless? Because any investigator, I mean, I myself am an investigative journalist, you have to pursue the story however difficult it becomes. And quite often, a big organisation like Amnesty will be threatened. So they will be, for example, finding evidence and information from witnesses, if they're looking carefully, that involves Israeli forces killing Israelis. This was clear right from the very start, after the 7th of October, Israelis themselves picking up the phone and phoning into the national radio phone-ins in Hebrew in Israel, explaining that they had witnessed and in fact been involved in and survived attacks on Israelis' kibbutzes by the Israeli Defense Forces themselves, because of this thing called the Hannibal Doctrine that everybody needs to know about. So the idea is, it doesn't matter if you kill your own citizens, so long as you, number one, kill Hamas, but number two, that you also create more death, because this gives you an excuse to complain more. That's it in a nutshell. For anyone that's not come across it, check out the Hannibal Doctrine. It doesn't sound to me as if the Amnesty International has actually really considered these aspects of the attacks.
The Israeli forces and settlers continue to launch violent attacks against Palestinians across the occupied West Bank, injuring civilians and vandalizing their property. In the city of Jenin, Israeli forces shot a Palestinian doctor in the thigh while he was leaving a funeral. The incident coincided with renewed settler raids into the Al-Aqsa Mosque compound in the occupied city of Al-Quds. The Israeli forces also raided the village of Beitin, northeast of Ramallah. Meanwhile, settlers continue to expand illegal outposts by adding new mobile homes to a settlement built on Mount Sabir, south of Nablus. Since the genocide in Gaza began, more than 1,000 Palestinians have been killed and over 20,000, including 1,600 children, abducted in the West Bank. Hundreds of protesters have rallied outside the UK Prime Minister's residence in London to urge the government to intervene in the case of hunger-striking Palestine Action prisoners. Protesters said at least 7 inmates across 5 prisons have refused food for up to 38 days, with an 8th fasting and alternate days despite being diabetic. We have talked to some of the demonstrators. Here's what they had to say.
Hunger strikers who are still on remand after a year are still on hunger strike, and the situation has not been resolved. To my knowledge, no meeting has been made with David Lammy, who should be taking action on this. The health of the hunger strikers deteriorates day on day, to the point where it's really quite serious now. It's life-changing.
These people have been on hunger strike for over a month. You know, their bodies are deteriorating. They're getting to a point where they're not going to recover unless they get help. But their conditions are so bad, and they're kind of left to the only last resort that they can think of, because all other avenues have been blocked, and they're not even convicted. They're literally wasting away in prison, not convicted. Their rights are being taken away. I think Cameron is not even allowed to really speak to his doctor to find out what his own condition is.
Those young people decided themselves, called Palestine Action, we need to do something. If we had a government in this country that would get off their backside and do something about the genocide in Palestine, number one, they could have stopped selling arms, drones, and all that killing equipment to have. They haven't stopped doing that. They're still doing it. And they were also carrying out flights out of Akatari in Cyprus for the Zionists.
Venezuelan President Nicolas Maduro has sharply condemned the U.S. seizure of an oil tanker in the Caribbean Sea. Nicolas Maduro called Washington's move an act of criminal naval piracy.
Absolutamente.
Yesterday, they committed an absolutely criminal and illegal act when they proceeded to carry out a military assault, kidnapping, and robbery like pirates of the Caribbean on a private civilian commercial merchant ship. A ship of peace that was assaulted almost as it was reaching the Atlantic. It was not off the coast of Venezuela, it was almost up there, much further, north of Trinidad and Tobago, towards the island of Grenada, already reaching the Atlantic. The crew of that ship, the vessel carrying 1,900,000 barrels of oil to international markets, paid for in Venezuela, because everyone who extracts oil pays for it first. They are kidnapped, they are missing, and no one knows where they are. They kidnapped the crew, they stole the ship. They have ushered in a new era, the era of criminal naval piracy in the Caribbean. So Venezuela rejects in its entirety this act of criminal piracy against the entire Caribbean. and I have already given sufficient instructions for all the necessary legal and diplomatic actions to be taken and measures to be implemented, because Venezuela will secure all ships to guarantee the free trade of its oil to the world.
Maduro was speaking in a televised address. The speech came just after the U.S. sanctioned three of his nephews, along with shipping companies that Washington accuses of moving Venezuelan oil to intensify pressure on the South American country. The Venezuelan government has filed a formal complaint with the International Maritime Organization denouncing the dangerous escalation by the U.S. The seizure marks the Trump administration's first known action against Venezuela's related tankers since it ordered a massive military buildup in the region. The U.S. has already conducted several strikes against vessels it claims were involved in drug trafficking, killing more than 80 people and drawing severe backlash from human rights organizations. Iran has categorically condemned the illegal seizure of a Venezuelan oil tanker by the U.S. off the country's Caribbean coast, calling it state-sponsored maritime piracy. Foreign Ministry spokesman said the seizure of commercial vessels belonging to other nations by the U.S. is in clear defiance of international law and a blatant violation of maritime security and safety principles. Ismail Baghaei stressed that invoking U.S. domestic laws or its illegal sanctions to justify this measure cannot change illegal and criminal nature of this armed maritime robbery. He also warned about the impact of such forceful measures on international peace, security and trade. Baghaei stressed that all governments and international organizations are responsible to oppose such illegal measures and hold the U.S. responsible. Iran's embassy in Caracas has earlier condemned the U.S. takeover of the vessel as an act of piracy, violation of Venezuela's national sovereignty, and a blatant breach of international law. Gladys Quesada says Washington's latest move marks a dangerous escalation, as it is a direct assault on Venezuela's vital resources.
The tanker was carrying 1.9 million oil barrels of crude oil, you know. So it was a very big amount. It was a very big cargo of crude oil. And he said that the ship was, you know, just above, north above of Grenada and Trinidad and Tobago at the time of the hijacking and the seizure. Also, we have to say that Venezuela has been saying, and the president said that this afternoon, that the nation is taking the appropriate measures to put a demand on this on the international instances. So the nation is not only, you know, condemning this, it's also taking action against it, and it's also preparing themselves to face this kind of actions. This means, and the president of Venezuela has been saying that, this means a new stage of the escalations and the hostilities against the Bolivarian nation. So they keep operating in waters close to Venezuela. They keep doing this, but now they are attacking the resources. They are attacking the assets of Venezuela. And the president of Venezuela has been saying that he is not afraid of this and that the nation is going to find the ways to keep, you know, doing commercial trade with oil and to keep, you know, selling the oil and, you know, commercial with the resources.
A U.S. senator has bitterly criticized President Donald Trump for deployment of troops to cities around the country, calling it a staggering and unlawful waste of taxpayers' money. Senator Tammy Duckworth said the deployment of U.S. troops to American cities has already cost over $341 million.
Yet these deployments are burning priceless readiness, morale, and resources on open-ended, unjustified missions. So far, this administration is estimated to have spent over $341.3 million on the deployments to Illinois, LA, Oregon, DC, and Memphis alone, not including the cost of thousands of troops along the border. But these costs are tabulated in more than taxpayer dollars and cannot be overstated, nor can the risk that comes with politicizing our troops for one man's gain. So let me close with this. Enabling the president, any president, to send military troops into American cities under transparently flimsy pretexts to meet his whims will have a dangerous and profoundly damaging impact on our nation's military.
Duckworth said U.S. troops did not sign up to intimidate the American people or defend one man's partisan agenda. She added that public trust can be easily lost when the commander-in-chief uses them so recklessly, especially when Trump suggests that the military uses American cities as training grounds for the war within. Democratic City leaders have filed lawsuits to block the troop deployments, calling them an attempt by Trump to punish political foes with militarized shows of force. A federal judge in California has ordered troops in Los Angeles to stand down, ruling Trump has exceeded his presidential authority. With legal battles mounting, the Supreme Court is expected to decide the legality of Trump's use of National Guard in Chicago, a decision with repercussions for other cities. And that is a wrap of this hour's news. Thank you so much for staying with us.
Choose to think better. Welcome to a better you. Visit us at parstoday.ir/en. IRIB English Radio.
Hello and welcome to Unscripted. I'm Kavita Akwaye. Our guest joining us in this edition of the program is Daniel McAdams. He is the Executive Director of the Ron Paul Institute for Peace and Prosperity. Also co-host of the Ron Paul Liberty Report. He has served as Foreign Affairs Advisor to U.S. Congressman Ron Paul from the years 2001 until Dr. Paul's retirement at the end of 2012. From 1993 to 99, he worked as a journalist based in Budapest, Hungary, including as editorial page editor of the Budapest Sun, and he also served as a special rapporteur for the British Helsinki Human Rights Group while based in Europe. And he joins us now for this edition of Unscripted. Daniel McAdams, welcome to the program.
Thank you for having me on your show. I appreciate it.
It's great having you. I actually want to break the ice and get warmed up with this post that you had about this brilliant film that you said made by an Israeli Jewish filmmaker 26 years ago. The reason why I'm starting out with this is because what stood out in your description there, which you said was an integral part of my awakening on the Israeli issue, maybe you could tell us in short what this film was all about and why you think it was important in your awakening on the Israeli issue.
Well, the film is, and I actually made a mistake in the initial post. It was, I think, 16 years ago, not 26 years ago. My math wasn't very good at the time I posted it. But it was, the filmmaker's name is Yoav Shamir. He's an Israeli filmmaker. He made that film. He also made Checkpoint and a few other films about the situation primarily in the West Bank, but certainly the situation among Palestinians. And what Defamation was about is the brainwashing of young Israelis from a very early age to the view that if they don't, you know, essentially destroy all of their enemies, another Holocaust will happen. And Yoav Shamir, in his brilliant way of making the film, Professor Finkelstein is in the film as well, but it really highlights how the Anti-Defamation League, the ADL in the United States, conspires to invent and create anti-Semitism where there really isn't any. And there are several scenes in the film where something very, very non-controversial is treated as an act of anti-Semitism. So it was an extremely well-done film, and it really moved me along in the process. Aren't always as they appear. That and Checkpoint, which is a great film that shows the horrible situation for West Bank residents when they want to go to the doctor and when they want to go to the store or anything, how they're treated like inhuman. And let's not forget, this is well over 10 years ago that he made this film. I'm absolutely certain it's much, much worse these days.
Well, let's talk about that a little bit, because I'm sure that then you must be shocked as to what's going on, not only in the Gaza Strip in terms of the genocide there, but also in terms of what's happening in the West Bank, which is, in essence, almost the same thing, but maybe it's in second gear at this point, moving on real fast in terms of displacement, in terms of all the different things that are happening, from human rights violations, et cetera. Does it surprise you when you see the genocide that has happened in terms of the depth that Israel has stooped to basically carve up the land? We know in the West Bank they're very proud to say we're going to take over 82% and annex it.
Well, what surprises me even more than that, because we've seen a pattern for decades of Israel's behavior, but they'd always had some sort of a check on their bloodthirstiness, and now the check is gone, the reins are off. What really surprised me is to see a world stand by while a genocide is taking place right before their eyes. And many of these people saying never again, rightly so, to the genocide that was launched toward the Jews in Europe in the 1930s and 40s, and we're having the same situation right before our eyes. And unlike in those years, we can actually tune into X or any other network and see in real time the destruction, the maiming of children, the killing of, they say, upwards perhaps even of hundreds of thousands, multiple hundreds of thousands of innocent civilians being killed. And the world stands by and does nothing. And it's primarily because the United States stands by and does nothing and watches this happen. This will be a black stain on the United States and the American people for centuries to come.
Taking a look at now what the Israeli regime is doing, we understand it's continuing the genocide no matter what. And obviously the U.S. has its back when it comes to the military support or the U.N. veto, as we just saw 24 hours ago. But we're also looking at an expansionist Israeli regime, where in West Asia, we call it West Asia, the Middle East, people know it as, and how it's going after other countries. And the attack on Qatar, I think, was a game changer in many different ways. We're looking at how the Israeli regime basically broke the regional taboos to hit a major non-NATO U.S. ally between Israel and Hamas. It's really incredible that they wanted to take out the host country that has the mediators there. What was your initial reaction on this? And do you think that that's a game changer? In what ways?
Well, not only that, it's such an act of treachery. And this is a pattern that Israel and the U.S. have done, which is to announce that you're going to have negotiations. And as soon as you gather the negotiators together, the Israelis, with the United States seal of approval, will kill those intermediaries, will kill those negotiators. It happened to Iran. We saw just before the sneak attack of Israel on Iran. It's happened in the past several times. It happened to Soleimani, who was getting ready to board a plane on a peace mission to negotiate peace when he was destroyed by Trump in the first administration. And now we see the same thing happening, attempted same thing happening in Qatar. There have been other instances as well where you actually kill the negotiators who are trying to negotiate peace. That is a clear signal. It should be a clear signal to the rest of the world how Israel views peace negotiations. The way Israel views peace negotiations is how they behaved toward Lebanon and Syria. We do regime change, we decapitate your regime, we disarm you completely, and then the peace that you get is the peace that we impose on you. And so the lesson should be clear for Israel's Arab neighbors, and sadly it doesn't seem to be getting through, but all you have to do is take a look at the map of Greater Israel, which they are not ashamed to show to anyone. They're not ashamed to hang it up behind them when they're speaking. They want a big chunk, not only of Saudi Arabia, but Iraq, of Turkey. And these countries still, they seem like it's, they don't view it as a serious threat. Well, I think with the one thing that Israel has shown in the last, since 2023 October, is that they're a threat to anyone, and they're not willing to back down. They will conquer every country in the region and subjugate it to Israel's will. So it's it's disheartening. You even have such a weak response from Qatar. Qatar is a major U.S. ally, the largest U.S. military base in the region. They clearly, unless the U.S. gave a green light, which probably is what happened, But then again, that speaks volumes as well. What a treacherous ally the U.S. is to greenlight an attack on a partner. So I would just say that the U.S. diplomacy has absolutely been destroyed by its absolute fealty, its absolute subservience to the state of Israel.
Well, I'd like to discuss that a little bit in detail in terms of the U.S. role here, because we know the U.S. President Donald Trump said that he was not aware that this was going to happen. And then he said, yes, we were given a heads up, but it was so late in the game that we didn't have a chance to really relay it in enough time for Qatar to react. But the skies over Doha, as far as we know, are monitored by Al Udeid, the largest U.S. military installation. We know that this is not a marginal outpost. It's the forward headquarters for the U.S. Central Command, U.S. CENTCOM. And in theory, anything entering Qatari airspace or nearby region without being detected by the IAMD, which is Integrated Air Missile Defense System, that provides air cover for the Persian Gulf Cooperation Council, which has Qatar, Saudi Arabia, Bahrain, and UAE, along with Jordan in it. There's no way that the U.S. would not have been aware of this Israeli intrusion into the Qatari airspace. So Trump's claim falls flat. Given that, are we looking at the fact that now the Persian Gulf Arab countries are definitely rethinking how the U.S. is claiming that it's the guarantor of their security, that just not going to happen in terms of how it suits the U.S.'s purpose?
Well, either the U.S. is completely incompetent and its weapons don't work to fulfill its obligations in the region to protect not only its own troops, of course, which is very important, but as you point out, its partners in the region. Either our weapons don't work very well or someone told them to stand down. Now, it may not have been the president. I think that's something that we have to consider, that there may be someone in control of this in his administration that is not him. He's not a detailed person. He doesn't like long briefings. He likes things very simplified. He may have just delegated this to someone, this whole operation to someone, and you know he can claim plausible deniability. Yeah, we knew about it, but it was late. Nobody's buying that. These things don't work that way. You don't just flip a switch on. As you point out, they're integrated. They're automatically integrated to protect our troops and our partners in the region, or they're not. So I would think that obviously they stood down, because the U.S. seems to have this idea. I believe it takes its Arab partners for granted, and there is a precedent for it because they have shown a lack of willingness to stand up in the face of continued behavior by the U.S. in the region that shows that they're not viewed as an equal partner. But maybe this may be the issue. This may be something that brings them together, but I don't think we've seen a lot of evidence so far.
Yeah, it was very interesting when that summit happened, when you had Qatar invite, and in attendance were obviously the countries in the Persian Gulf, including not only Bahrain, the UAE, but also Iran attended. And at the end, the final communique was basically words of condemnation. Many were very disappointed in that. But then lo and behold, you had this Pakistan-Saudi Arabia defense pact, which that was quite an eye-opener. I'm wondering why Saudi Arabia chose Pakistan, because when you take a look at the fact that Pakistan is nuclear armed, and then for the military agreement to happen, Mohammed bin Salman said that promises to boost defense cooperation and joint deterrence. Tell us your reaction to this joint pact, and how much of a possibility is there for other countries to join in?
Well, I think the prince was sending a very clear signal to the U.S. in this. Probably the strongest and clearest signal that it can send to the U.S. I wonder about Pakistan's reliability, because the U.S. is always trying to infiltrate the Pakistani government. They've jailed Pakistan's independent-minded leaders in the name of Imran Khan and others. So the question is the reliability. But yes, definitely, there's no question about it. You're right. I mean, the juxtaposition of this conference in the Gulf and this agreement just a few days later sends a clear signal. And I think the signal is that that Saudi Arabia is ready to become a nuclear armed country very quickly if this stuff keeps happening.
Why don't we take a look at the fact that you have the Iran coming into the picture after this attack by Qatar, and for the countries to basically reach the terms that Iran has been dealing with when it comes to Israel in terms of it attacking Iran, and Iran saying, see, I told you so, the U.S. cannot be a reliable partner. By default, obviously, the U.S. is behind Israeli moves in the region. Do you think we're looking at now a proactive move by countries in the region to align themselves in order to stand up against the U.S. and Israel? Because like you mentioned, Israel is on a war footing. It wants to expand itself, and other countries are in its firing line.
Well, the other thing to consider is that Israel is also in a race against time. Now, if you look at polling in the United States, support for Israel as it is at the lowest in its history. You know, Megyn Kelly, who's a very famous U.S. journalist talk show host, said just a couple of days ago in a discussion she had with Tucker Carlson that if you look at the United States, literally everybody under 30 hates Israel. And that's a fact. And it's not just those on the left. It's young American conservatives in the 18 to 40 range who are, for the first time in my entire life, polling shows that the majority of them are opposed to our relationship to Israel. So Israel, I think, understands that it's a race against time. U.S. support right now can only be bought by our bought and paid for Congress and our bought and paid for administration. So they may believe that they have to go for broke now because this may be their last chance. Unfortunately, what that means is they have absolutely no compunction about killing every woman, child, baby, pregnant mother, even donkey in sight. They are going for broke on this, which is a bad situation. But they are also in a situation where they have no allies in the world, no allies in the entire world. And the only ally they have, the United States, is only an ally because the government is bought and paid for by AIPAC and other pro-Israel organizations. And don't forget the multi-billionaire Jewish, primarily Jewish, Americans who put Israel before their own country.
You know, I found it very interesting that just a few days back, you had the Israeli Prime Minister, Benjamin Netanyahu, who came out, and it's one of those rare admissions where he said that, you know, we are somewhat isolated. We have to deal with that fact. And he made a referral to how its economy is not doing well. And in particular, he talked about how Israel needs to be self-reliant when it comes to the arms industry. Because, for example, the UAE and some other countries have actually barred Israel from attending some of these arms expos. Now, when you have the Israeli Prime Minister say that, he says it with confidence as if he's, you know, nothing's going to deter Israel from, again, going on this war footing and expanding itself, which is going to involve more wars. Do you think that that's because it knows that the U.S. is actually going to be behind Israel all the way, and that is why the Prime Minister speaks with such confidence on the matter?
Well, that's one of the few times I would agree with Netanyahu. I mean, if that's your goal, go for it. You know, if your goal is to develop your arms industry independently, but that would also mean without the U.S. dollars, without U.S. technology, without U.S. support. If that's your goal, then I'm all for it, Bibi. Go for it. You know, but I don't think that's the case. I think it's, it wants the gravy train to continue. And don't forget, it's not just American tax dollars that are going for the Israeli military, but a lot of American tax dollars go into it's like a laundromat, a money laundering scheme, where they go into PR firms and think tanks in the Beltway that continue to push our relationships. So the American, poor American worker who's suffering with terrible inflation and a terrible economy is being robbed to pay to be propagandized in favor of being robbed to pay to being propagandized. It's a vicious circle, and the loser is always the American people and, of course, the people on the other end of Israeli bullets and bombs.
All right, let's move on to another topic, and that is one of the countries we mentioned somewhat, which is Iran. What has happened in the past day is the UN Security Council failing to adopt that draft resolution that basically enabled the snapback to officially now be activated. Now, you have to put things into perspective for us, which I'd like for you to do, but I'm looking at the context of Iran trusting the U.S., trusting its European allies. You're looking at, five rounds of discussions that Iran had with the U.S., of which it then got bombed just a couple days later when they were supposed to have a meeting. And then you have the Europeans, where Iran talked with, made an agreement with the IAEA in Cairo, and yet you have, again, this snapback to come back into play. What reasons does Iran have then to actually continue this diplomacy that it's still open to do, But, you know, it keeps getting chipped away in terms of its confidence on having diplomacy with the Western nations.
Well, I'm not an expert on public opinion within Iran, but I would guess, if I could speculate, that the Iranian people are probably starting to get frustrated as well, maybe even with their leaders, that we keep trying to play by the rules and we keep getting kicked in the teeth. You know, at what point are we going to say enough? And I'm sure it's a pretty big discussion in Iran among the people. And I saw some things in parliament where there was some anger and frustration about being willing to deal with the IAEA again after what many or most of us consider the treachery of revealing sensitive information that may have led to the murder of a lot of Iranian scientists. So, yes, they've played by the rules. My good friend Larry Johnson, who is a CIA officer and a great writer, he points out that he believes the Cairo Agreement was a pretty clever idea on the part of Iran to appeal to its very legalistically minded friends in Russia and China and elsewhere. I believe also Pakistan and Algeria have also said that they will not follow along with the snapback sanctions. And I think that the Cairo Agreement helped facilitate that, because Russia and China especially can point to it and say, look, they are doing everything they can to avoid this. They're doing everything they can. They're going to even let the inspectors back in, the people who they suspect of betraying them. They're willing to go this far, and still they get nothing for it. So that having been said, with the snapbacks going back into effect, at least from what I understand, maybe there's some new information, but that Iran has said that, well, the Cairo Agreement is off then. If you're not going to consider this, then forget it. And if that is the case, it's probably a smart move the way they did it.
Well, that is something that's being discussed. They have not actually declared that to be null and void. They're looking also at another option, which they have discussed, but they haven't gone through yet, the official government line, and that is still being a member of the NPT. But do you think that these moves that are being initiated and now executed by the Europeans in terms of the snapback and by the U.S., whom doesn't seem to be interested in having any form of diplomatic talks at this point, is because that is what their intentions are, for Iran to want not to allow IAEA inspectors in the country, withdraw from the NPT to give them a reason, therefore, that, see, this is, as they would like to call it, a rogue nation, we need to attack it.
Yeah, I think that's a big part of it. But, you know, the other issue is unrelated to Iran, excuse me, pardon me, and that is European frustration with Russia and China, particularly with regard to the Ukraine war. So in some ways, you know, Iran is in the middle, because the Europeans want to punish the Russians, certainly the Chinese, for continuing to do business with Iran, for ignoring the snapbacks, and Russia as well. So in a way, it's Iran getting the short end of the stick, even though they agreed to some of these points with the Cairo Agreement. The Europeans have nothing left. They've destroyed their economy. They've destroyed their credibility. They're chasing shadows around, thinking that they're going to destroy Russia and overthrow Russia and invade Russia. So they're grasping at straws. They're desperate. And so I think that's one of the reasons that Iran is kind of a victim here, being caught in the middle of this European war against Russia.
I'm curious about the support of the U.S. I know we're back to that, even though we just covered that. You know, you had the words of Donald Trump that headlined in many periodicals online that said, Benjamin Netanyahu is me. Obviously, I'm not going to use the word. Okay, at the same time, we're seeing how Benjamin Netanyahu is being enabled by the U.S. It almost makes it sound like Trump saying that there's nothing I can do about that, but he realizes what the Israeli regime is doing. I mean, you know, Israeli regime, again, it's aside from the countries that it's targeting, it's also targeting the resistance groups in the region. And we're headed for some times here, like Lebanon, where God knows what's going to happen if this disarmament of Hezbollah is going to be, which is not going to go away, from the U.S.'s sites, including Israel. What do you think about Trump, first of all? Is he in the middle of not being able to do anything, even though he realizes that Israel is, through Netanyahu, doing whatever it wants?
I just don't buy it, you know, because we've seen this before. We've seen Trump express this frustration with Netanyahu before, and I think it's just for domestic consumption. I'm very upset with Netanyahu. And then he holds out the chair for him, right? It was like a couple of days later. This is PR stuff. If Trump were really felt that Netanyahu was giving him the what for, let's put it that way, then there are many moves that he could make. It's just like with everything else with Trump. It's just hollow air. It's hollow wind. There's no substance to anything that he says. So, I mean, I think the only interest Trump has in the whole region is the idea of developing the Gaza Strip into some sort of a big Trumpian paradise, for his son-in-law to make more billions off of. And I say this as someone who wanted Trump to win. I do not have Trump derangement syndrome. I was happy that Trump won. I don't vote, so I didn't vote for him, but I was happy that he won. So I'd simply judge him on his actions as president. And between this and blowing up a bunch of ships, a bunch of little boats outside of Venezuela, and constant bombing of Somalia and other places, the idea that he's the peace president is getting a little bit worn thin.
Well, he recently came out and made another revelation, of which he did talk about prior when he ran for presidency back in the year, I believe, 2020, and that's about trying to get back Bagram Air Base. I mean, let's spare thought here for Trump, who is supposed to be a peace president based on the platform he ran on. But as you said, he's bombing countries. He's launched deadly military strikes, civilian boats that you mentioned, preemptive military strikes on Iran. You have the bombing campaign in Yemen. Let's see, what else have we got? A desire to annex Canada, Greenland, Panama Canal, the Gaza Strip, and now directing Pentagon to target these drug cartels in Mexico as well. Now focusing on Afghanistan. I mean, did he put on a show, do you think, so he can pursue his goals now that he's reached power?
And don't forget his war on the American people, the war on the First Amendment here at home. If you happen to say something critical of Israel, you're going to get nabbed. If you happen to be a foreign permanent resident, you're going to be sent back to where you came from. So there's war on every single front, even as he comically says that he's solved seven wars, and it would have been eight if he only would have been able to solve the Russia war, but he's still working on it. It's sort of it really is, he's famous for being a reality TV star. This really is the reality TV show president, where every week there's a new chapter, there's a new episode that comes out with some new comical scheme that we can all laugh at and think, aha, that's crazy, that's funny. It just feels that way. It feels like we're all being gaslit by this administration. And I've never seen, in my memory goes back to the Nixon administration even, I've never seen an administration this chock full of incompetence, of people who don't understand the basics of the American Constitution, for example. His attorney general saying that we don't have any right for hate speech and it'll be prosecuted, we're going to hunt you down. She doesn't understand the Constitution. It really is a government of the most incompetent people I've ever seen in my life.
Well, maybe there's a silver lining to all of this in terms of what's happening with other countries, in particular in the East. I don't know if you caught some of the scenes coming out of the SCO that was held in Tianjin in China. And basically, many headlines read, global wealth and power are pivoting to the East, China building its relationship with India in terms of the BRICS countries, surpassing the G7 in terms of their economic output. I don't know if you saw the scenes of almost a huddle between the Chinese president, the Indian president, and the Russian president. Of course, Iran is part of the SCO as well as a member. Are we really looking at this pivot to mark a new global order that surpasses the previous global order, but for it now to be perhaps more active in standing up to the U.S.?
It's amazing to see what's become of the SCO. I actually visited the headquarters in Shanghai back, I think, in 2006 when it was just getting started. And I was working for Dr. Paul at the time. We both had an inkling that this might turn out to be something significant, a different move for the rest of the world. And it obviously, this latest conference has shown, as you very well point out, has shown a serious, serious level of coordination and organization. The real tragedy here is that the U.S. should want to be part of this. These are countries that are investing in development in technologies that we don't even have in the U.S. We spend at least $1.5 trillion a year on our military, on protecting our overseas empire, while Americans are struggling to survive in an economy that's terrible with inflation out of control. We should want to be part of this. That's the ethos of America, doing business overseas, trading. It could be enormously profitable for the United States. But unfortunately, we're governed by a bunch of knuckleheads who only know how to enrich the military-industrial complex to the detriment of every one of the rest of us.
All right, and my final question to you, since we have run out of time, unfortunately, I had so much more to cover with you, is the fact that we are still looking at many who are interpreting this ceasefire between Israel and Iran to be temporary, that Israel is going to attack Iran again. Israel just boasted about their laser beam, defense shield that acts like a defense shield for any incoming missiles. Iran just tested its own Khorramshahr, which is said to be able to penetrate, obviously, the Israeli airspace and hit its target with pinpoint accuracy. It did so on many occasions in the 12-day war. If there was a war to be ignited, what type of outcome? I know this is just speculation, but what type of outcome do you foresee happening here?
Well, first of all, no one wants it to happen. Certainly I don't, and you don't. No one in Iran wants it to happen. Most people in the United States do not want it to happen. But I don't think the Israelis can – they don't have an off switch right now. They are fired up, and they're ready to destroy all of the people they consider to be their enemies. So I think there's a very, very high chance of Israel doing it again. And they're going to want to – and I hope I'm wrong. For God's sake, I hope I'm wrong. They're going to want to do it as they see support for Israel flagging in the United States, as I said earlier. They're going to want to do it sooner rather than later. I hope it doesn't happen. But certainly, I mean, if I were in charge of Iran, I would never let my guard down. And I think even the head of the Mossad said the other day, we have even more treachery planned, even more secret, nasty things that we have planned for Iran. And we saw what they did last time by infiltrating their agents into Iran and killing a lot of very, very important key people. So unfortunately, I don't think they have an off switch. They're not going to not do it. And I think there's a lot of people cheering Iran on, believing that that Israel needs to have a real black eye so they, you know, basically sober up and stop acting like the bully in the neighborhood.
All right. Daniel McAdams, thank you so much for this interview. We appreciate it.
Thank you.
Well, you just heard Daniel McAdams, executive director of the Ron Paul Institute. We ended it on the fact that he does believe that there will be another attack by Israel on the Islamic Republic. Of course, way that the Iranian military has been testing some of the different missiles like the Khorramshahr that I stated shows that it'll be up for a bruising. From Mikhail Tafoy and the entire team here at Unscripted, it's goodbye.
I've trusted you a thousand times, but you always bring me back to the same place. My heart is moaning, but you can't hear. What do you care about me except my face? You think you know everything, you think you're enough, but sometimes a tiny virus ruins your life. You have so many heroes, but only in movies. I've tried all you said. Is there any way left to say? I've tried all you said.
I'm a teacher.
I'm a researcher.
I'm a mother.
I'm a lawyer.
And I believe in acting kindly toward you, because you are
A Muslim lady.
You are very special. There's no one just like you. You are very special, and I'm so glad you're mine.
بسم الله الرحمن الرحيم. إنا أعطيناك الكوثر فصل لربك وانحر إن شانئك هو الأبتر. السلام عليكم dear ladies from all around the world. Welcome to a new episode of Muslim Lady. Well, today's episode is all a celebration on the auspicious occasion of the blissful birthday of the world's most outstanding lady, فاطمة الزهراء سلام الله عليها.
فاطمة مولاتي فاطمة فاطمة مولاتي فاطمة فاطمة مولاتي فاطمة فاطمة مولاتي فاطمة فاطمة مولاتي فاطمة.
On this very happy occasion of the birthday of Lady Fatima Salamullah Alayha, I welcome you to a new episode of Muslim Lady. Assalamu alaikum, Sister Zainab.
Wa alaikum assalam.
Congratulations.
Thank you. I also extend my congratulations to you on this very auspicious occasion of birthday of Lady Zahra Salamullah Alayha, which is also the
Women's Day.
Yes.
And it's Eid, of course.
Yes, of course.
It's
for all women.
To all women out there, to all the Muslim ladies especially. And if we want to be the followers of this great lady, of this great outstanding lady, then we have to follow her lifestyle. As we have been doing that for weeks, we are focusing on the way she lived, on the narrations that actually has been passed to us through different books and different scholars. Now we know more about her. So if we want to achieve salvation according to her, if we want to be among her followers, we have to be more careful about how we act, and we have to know her more and more in order to get closer to how she was. So since we want to know more about her, Sister Zainab is here to tell us about the sources that are going to make it more clear for us to get closer to know her.
As you rightly mentioned that we gotta know her more and more. The more we know her and the more we get closer to her, the more we can follow her. So there are many sources you can get to know about Lady Zahra Salamullah Alayha, but I would refer to a very few in this episode. The first source is obviously the Holy Book of Quran. We already mentioned that she is introduced in Surah Kawthar. And then there are many other surahs where she is mentioned. Like, there's this verse of Tathir, or also called this verse of purification. It's the verse 33 of Surah Ahzab, which reads, "Indeed, Allah desires to repel all impurity from only you, Ahlul Bayt, and purify you with thorough purification." It talks about the purification of Ahlul Bayt, and the Shia school of thought also uses this verse as a source to defend the infallibility. Allah subhanahu wa ta'ala introduces Ahlul Bayt in this verse and talks about their purification. Now, is there any verse that talks about how Fatima Zahra salamu alayha is Ahlul Bayt? Yes, there is also the verse of Mubahila, which is from the verse 61 of chapter 3. And there was this encounter of Prophet, peace be upon him, with the Christians of Najran. And then they called the elders, and Prophet also called his Ahlul Bayt, making it clear who were Ahlul Bayt.
Yeah, thank you, sister. So, dear listeners, thank you for being with us. Let's go for a short break, and we'll be back in no time.
In the name of Allah, the All-Beneficent, the All-Merciful, indeed we have given you abundance.
Welcome back. You're listening to Muslim Lady. Well, dear Muslim ladies, we're talking about Lady Fatima Salamullah Alayha. And Sister Zainab was telling us about the purification verse in the Holy Book of Quran. And let's listen to more.
The verse of purification, which is also called as Ayat Tathir, or which is the verse 33 of Surah Ahzab, introduces Ahlul Bayt as pure. And then there's this verse number 61 of chapter 3, which introduces who are Ahlul Bayt, like Allah, Prophet introduces, or Allah subhanahu wa ta'ala introduces Imam Ali as Anfusana, the soul of Prophet. And he introduces Hasnan, the Imam Hasan and Imam Hussein al-Islam, as Abna, the sons of Prophet, and Lady Zahra salam alayha as Nisa'ana, the women. There were many more people in the household of Prophet, Uncle Abbas, their sons, and so many other people, but he brought these chosen people and he called them as Ahlul Bayt. And you know, there was a verse coming in, the verse of verse 61 of chapter 3, introducing them, who they are. So it's very clear who are Ahlul Bayt. Then there's a verse about their infallibility. And also, there's one more verse which talks about her character, the way she behaved. Like there's a saying that she once was, her sons were very ill, and then she keeps fast. And then at the time of when she prepares iftar, some of the breads, then some of the three times the door gets, you know, struck, and there are people asking for food. And she gives away all three times. And then she breaks her fast with a glass of water. And then also a verse of Surah Hal-Ata or Surah Insan gets revealed, which says, Bismillah ar-Rahman ar-Rahim. They are those who fulfill their vows and fear a day of sweeping horror and give food despite their desire for it to the poor, to the orphan, and to the captive. Talking about Quran, it talks all about her qualities. Talking about Prophet Muhammad is another source. His words are another source we can refer to her, who used to, you know, kiss her hand, stand for her in her honor, respect her. And, you know, in the days of ignorance, when everyone was so, so ignorant, he would stand up in her honor and he would kiss her hands. And he would often, quite often, tell her that may your dad get sacrificed for you.
Yeah, teaching other men of his time, how is it to respect a woman?
Exactly. And on this, we would have no Women's Day if Prophet never did that.
Exactly. So yeah. How kind he has been to his daughter.
Exactly. So if we are receiving gifts today, if we're getting honor today, it's all because of his respect he showed towards his daughter.
Yeah.
And then also, obviously, Imam Ali al-Islam, how he used to refer to her. She also called him as Ya Sayyidina. He also referred to her as Ya Sayyidina, which means my leader.
Mm-hmm.
So do you see, even today, men have that kind of, you know, ego. They can't call her exactly, their lives as leader, yeah, but yeah. Imam Ali al-Islam calls her as, yeah, Sayyidina, you know, you are my leader.
So this is the beauty of our religion, actually, that even our prophet is such a respectful man toward women.